Hiko, and you're watching Thorin's YouTube.
Right, this is going to be another episode of Daring Minds, the show where now we dare to not even have guests, even though, realistically, you're not even like the most established person in Valorant, and I am nobody in Valorant, so we are definitely pushing the boat out by attempting to do an episode without guests, but that's the other thing. I also do want to actually, this is the one of the tricky parts about doing these shows, is I'll say straight up to you, because if you haven't noticed, one of the ways I do it is I sort of break the fourth wall in my shows, because I just find it, like, it's not, we're not a real TV show, we don't have to hide all the shit from the fans, you know. So, like, one thing I tried to do on my shows, obviously, is whoever my co-host is, I want to, like, feature their knowledge and bring them into convos and stuff, but I will say the one issue is this, you're actually like a tiny bit too British and too polite, because I'm used to, like, remember, it's normally like Monte Cristo, like Richard Lewis, like, I don't have to ask them to talk, they're just going to jump in whenever they want, you know, like, so, like, sometimes, you know, if we have a guest, it can dominate the convo a little bit, but it's all baby, it's all you, it's your platform.
Oh, you're so kind.
The camera,
well,
we've even leveled up.
When we bring people in, I let them talk. I didn't realize that was a bad thing.
Listen, in general, you're doing a good job, but just essentially, if you ever want to say something, just jump in whenever you feel like it. Don't worry about it. Also, we've leveled the production up. Well, part of it. Like, her camera looks great. Mine, because I also do like to generally make the people look equally sized. So normally I'm a bit smaller, right? So now I do, just because it's full, we're in the full summer now, I do just look like a gammon completely. I am like red as fuck. That's because I'm not a master of cinematography. I don't know the light setup or what shade I'm supposed to use.
You're nearing your 40s, that's what it is.
Could be.
It's like a rite of passage.
It is. To some degree, I definitely don't tan. That should go without saying. Right, let's get into the topic, because obviously VCT Masters was ongoing the last few weeks. The same way I wanted to do an episode last week, even though we didn't have a guest, because, like, to me, those are like, there's only bloody like three of them in a year, so we've got to cover these. Like, if we don't cover these, what's the point in going balls deep on like fucking VCT online qualifier to get into the stage that gets you to this land? Like, it's a bit silly. So let's just start at the top, right? I forget, no point beating around the bush. Let's start with the winners, right? The winners, obviously. Are even, by the way, one of our first guests was Ardis from FBX. Yeah. We had him all that way back. And if you go back and watch that episode, he was a very confident person. Like, he not only thought Europe was the best, he thought NA is overrated, he thought his team were the shit. By the way, a lot of this is fucking aged very well. Thought Angel was great. Now, obviously, the crazy thing with this team, like I mentioned on the last episode, is they should have been at the previous Masters but didn't get to go, hence Team Liquid replaced them. And this time around, it's crazy they've won because they didn't even know they'd have their real team there. Like, what if the Sigetsu guy didn't even make it there? Didn't get the visa?
The whole story, I think I tweeted this the other day. I was like, I'm pretty sure the story of FPX is probably the coolest story we've had. I put in Valorant history so far, and there was definitely someone who got really pissy about me saying Valorant history because Valorant's really new. And I was like, that's why I put so far. It hasn't existed for 3 days. Like, it's still 2 years, fine. Like, yes. We'll take what we can get. But no, really, like, the whole story of the fact that they had all of this shit, like, the shit doesn't even go back to just the last Masters event, but actually the regular season before then, because they were playing with a sub for all of the playoffs of that. Like, the whole bracket, they had a sub come in. He subbed in for Angel, who is their IGL, and then also he had to sub in for Ardis after that. So they had a sub who was covering two different roles, very different roles on the team, still got them to the grand finals of that bracket, and still won that grand finals, and that's what qualified them for Reykjavik, and then they couldn't go to Reykjavik because of the visa problems, and Ardis had COVID. They couldn't like have a 3 out of 5.
Oh, that was right. Yes, he had that test thing. Yeah, sure.
And so they could not field 3 out of 5 of their players, and therefore they had to not go. They were given like a consolation prize, essentially. They got some circuit points. They got some of the prize money. But like, one of the really big things that we've spoken about on this podcast, especially, is how much like Valorant changes and the unpredictability of the teams who end up qualifying for things, right? Like, there are very few teams who have consistently qualified for these events. So you miss an event, like, it's entirely possible you're not making the next one. At least that's how Valorant is right now. And so they had to face that, with also the whole Ukraine issue still being a problem.
Oh, for sure,
and therefore, you know, that, you know, all of that shit. They qualify, and then you find out Sugetsu can't come, at least not for the group stages, because of visa problems. They didn't think Shao, it was actually crazy that Shao, who is also Russian, got his visa in time. Like, he narrowly got the visa in time. And Angel, I think it was Angel who said that they only got one day of practice before the group stages of playing with the actual roster who was going to be competing, because they had been practicing with two subs, assuming that Shao wouldn't be able to make it.
Right.
So they had like one scrim day with the actual fucking roster, and then you just got to hope that Sugetsu is going to make it. But even before you hope that Sugetsu is going to make it, you got to hope that you actually managed to make it into the fucking playoffs in the first place. And they were like in ostensibly the easier group, but you know, they were with DRX, and DRX beat them in the group stage. But also, you know, their first game was against Xersha, the Thai team. And that was like a uncomfortably close game for FBX. So it was, I don't want to say it was like a bad group stage for them, but it wasn't like a super impressive group stage. Their round differential was zero. So like, of all the teams that qualified in for the playoffs from the group stage, they did the worst. So all of that was exceptionally precarious. And then Sugetsu finally manages to come in. And this is a young player. Sugetsu's 20. And I, as far as I'm aware, he doesn't have LAN experience. And he comes in and you think like, okay, it's a young player. Like there's a lot of pressure on him. Like, is he really going to be able to, you know, what are you going to do with this? This is kind of a crazy situation. The man fucking pops off. Like, what the hell? Young players don't do that. Like, it's so rare to see young players actually be able to pull that off, especially in a situation like as crazy as that. Like, the mitigating circumstances here is actually wild. And yeah, he was just absolutely like a complete nutbag. In fact, in the grand finals, he solidified the final round with a 4K. So I don't know. Like, the whole thing is just like crazy. It's something that you could make up and be like, that's so unlikely. Like, no team's ever going to go through that. And yet they somehow, that somehow is their reality.
You know, the problem I've realized now, you know, when you see something, you can't unsee it. You know, when you posted that clip on, like, I can't remember if it was on Instagram or Twitter, you posted that clip of you when you're like 10 years old or something, interviewing your brother at like some race course. The problem with that is now every time you react really emotionally, I just think of that girl. Like, I imagine her just going, he fucking popped off. Man. He's fucking popping off.
Like, dude, that the best thing.
Because you're right. It looks like you were just like groomed to do this job or something. Like, you were good. Well, it was quite good.
The best thing about that clip is, as like a side note, is the bit where I'm interviewing my brother and I'm like seven, and my brother's like just younger than me. He's about a year and a half younger than me. And I go, Kieran, look at the camera.
Yeah, you have the you actually have the wherewithal to know, like, your on-camera presence is a deal. That's actually legit, because people don't know that is one of the main things about being camera talent, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's legit. That's legit.
Oh, that was a while ago that I posted that as well. I'm amazed that you remember that.
It's all right. Because, okay, what about that angle then? Because that's the other thing I was going to ask is this. Normally, when someone wins the tournament, it's pretty obvious who the MVP should be. Who do you think actually the MVP was for this tournament? Who would you have picked?
You know what? I actually don't remember who the MVP was. Sugetsu, right? He got the MVP.
I'll double check. I think
so.
It was.
They did a Twitter poll, which the sad thing about Twitter polls is that you can only have four options. So four out of the five players are on this. Twitter
so poll. Whoever gets left off just looks like they're getting flamed. Yeah, exactly.
Like,
true. Yeah, true. yeah.
That's a really hard question, because I think both. Oh my God. I mean, so there are two different ways of looking at this.
He did get the MVP. He did win it.
Yeah, I thought it was him. You can look at, like, the crazy performance within the grand finals, and I think that in that case, Sugetsu is very, you know, deserving of that. I think that you could also look at Shao for that as well, because I think that, especially throughout the course of the playoffs, Shao got better and better. But I was really surprised at how few people voted for Angel. And I get it. It's like, especially with the Twitter poll, and you've had someone who's had this really insane pop-off, like, series and performance, and the fact that he's come into the playoffs and just...
The narrative really angle helps, doesn't it? Yeah, came last second. Yeah,
it's
sure.
insane. Like, the narrative helps, and also, like, the fact that the way he plays is very, like, visually obvious, if that makes sense. But the thing with Angel, I think that I would say that he's probably deserving of more credit, is the fact that Angel, like, did not do well in the group stage. Like, he was really struggling. His statistics were some of the worst in the entire tournament. And people were really concerned. And he, I think, to get through that, to have the uncertainty of the position of where your team is and not knowing who's going to be playing in the playoffs and how you're going to go about this, to have to IGL through that and also improve your own statistics enough that you can have a really competitive lower bracket run, I think the amount internally that Angel will have had to have gone through in his own head to get the team to that point where they can make it to the grand finals and win is probably deserving of an MVP for like a playoffs run, let's say. And obviously that's not something that's like necessarily provable in a server in the same way that like Sugetsu's performance is, for example. So, you know, it's two sides of like a different coin, and I understand why Sugetsu got it, and I don't think he's undeserving of it, but I would have liked to have seen Angel get more credit for that, because I think the number of people who voted Angel in that poll was like the lowest of all four options.
I saw there was a different website, actually, like one of the community sites gave it to Shao, actually. So that's what I want to ask. Oh, was really? This in their team in FPX, how would you describe to the layman, like, is this a unique setup in their team? Like, obviously Shao's the initiator, like who does, like, what's the sort of burden of carry, as it were, in their team? Who has to be the star, do you think?
The burden of carry, I think that's the crazy thing about FPX, is like if someone like puts a gun to your head and says pick one carry from this team, then I'm gonna get shot. Like, you can't, there isn't one carry. But I think the reputation that FPX really built for themselves this year, even from very early in the year, is that they can play in so many different playstyles, and they basically choose that playstyle rather unpredictably based on the situation that they are, you know, handed. And that makes them very hard to prepare for and read into. I think there was an interview with like one of the players. It might have been Angel for like one of the content pieces that they did for Masters. And he's like, good luck trying to prepare for what we're going to bring out, because even we don't fucking know what we're going to bring out
until
we do it, right? It's sure. Like, and that's kind of been the, you know, the FPX MO, at least of this year. And right. I think that's really played into their success. So one of the like kind of great things about them is the fact that, yes, obviously everybody's playing the roles that they play. I mean, like, yeah, you're pretty much always going to see like artists as the duelist, for example. But there is that ability, like, to have a lot of flexibility, I think, in this team, and be able to pick up whatever you need to play however you need to, in the way that they see fit in the moment.
The other thing that's wild as well is when you consider, because they came through the lower bracket, because they obviously lost immediately to Fnatic in the upper bracket. If you look at how many teams they actually played, they beat like 8 teams in the whole tournament. Like, if you look, they actually played like every favorite pretty much and beat them. Like, this is a mega legit performance.
So it was really interesting. Bala tweeted something just before the grand finals. It was like the day before the grand finals. And he said, to get to the grand finals, the fewest number of games you can do it in is 4, and the maximum number of games you can do it in is 9. PaperX got to the grand finals in 4 games, and FPX got to the grand finals in 9 games. So they were literally on the extreme ends of what is possible to even get to the grand finals in. But I think that's what you mentioned there is like a very interesting thing about FPX, because there are usually few teams that get the opportunity to face teams from basically every region. So they didn't face every single region because, like, for example, they didn't get to play against, like, Loud, right? So
it was basically only, like, LATAM, I think, they missed, right?
Right.
Loud or Brazil. Yeah, those are the only two they missed, I think.
But it was, like, kind of the big thing. You know, there are certain teams who have this kind of narrative that they haven't been able to play like a team from X or Y region on an international stage, just because that's how brackets have gone when they happen to have played. So FPX, I mean, they might be the team that has played teams from the most regions, at least in one event. You'd have to really line them up against someone like Optic, who have been to a lot of events. And I think that that is a notable thing. I mean, yes, they had to play against both of their fellow regional teams in Guild and Fnatic. So they played both of the EMEA teams. They actually played Fnatic a couple of times in this bracket. They played Guild once. But they got to play against DRX, who beat them in the group stage, and they 2-0'd them in the lower bracket. You know, they got to play against Optic, who are obviously the incumbent champions up until this point. That, again, like, is a kind of scary thing. And then in the group stage, they played against like Xersha, Northeption as well, two teams who come from various parts of the APAC region. So yeah, they got to face a lot of different things. And I think even then, you consider the fact that because Paper X was the team that they were playing in the grand finals, Paper X probably could be attributed as having like the most unique play style any team right now. And they didn't come across them up to that point. So even though they'd faced all these teams of different play styles in different regions, they still had like the final boss as the final boss, right? And that could have been, it could have been like not enough, it, you know, and especially as it went to five maps, right? Like, so it goes to show what kind of like variety and stuff there is. But I think that will come to be a big boon to them, especially as they obviously now have qualified for Champions. So they'll be there. And, you know, having had experience of playing all of these different teams, I think will be a valuable thing going into that tournament.
So, okay, let's talk about Paper X, the team you were mentioning. As I said on the last episode, in some ways, I actually think if you wanted like a pure narrative angle to make like the game seem exciting, Paper X winning VCT would be amazing, because basically it would signal to people from other FPS games, like, this game isn't just Europe and North America. And in fact, as you say, they even have the most unique playing style. I think it would be a brilliant sort of like storyline to break Valorant out sort of a bit more mainstream. And obviously the cool angle of like, wow, the best team in the world from fucking, obviously in this case, not a region at all associated with being elite in esports, except maybe like Dota or something. So I think it would have been a crazy storyline. So what do you actually think? Like, what essentially was it, were they good enough to win this event? You think they could have won on a different sort of day if they woke up and teams played a bit differently?
I mean, they be the best team? I actually thought the Paper X were going to win this grand finals. I felt like FPX, I mean, as soon as FPX got to the lower round three, which was when they played against Fnatic, that's when I started to become unsure about how far I thought FPX were going to go beyond that. Because with Fnatic, assuming they beat Fnatic, which they did, they were then going to have to face Optic, which is obviously a very difficult opponent. And I was just kind of like, you know, they've had a sort of tumultuous run through Masters so far, and it could go wrong at any point. So I started to become a little bit unsure, but I had a lot of faith in Paper X because they just seemed very unstoppable. And I think the thing with Paper X is with their unique playstyle, it kind of almost didn't matter like how you performed against other teams, because they were going to be their own beast. But I think that like the interesting thing about the way that this game even went, I'm just getting the maps up from the game, is so the teams, I mean, like this is the crazy thing. Paper X were the upper bracket team, so they got to pick both bans, which in theory should have been obviously like a huge advantage. And they, like, FPX dominated Paper X on the first map, and it was Bind, which is a map that FPX tried to avoid quite a lot. And that was Paper X's first pick as well. So in theory, they should, you know,
it's supposed to be a punish pick,
right. They would have thought that this was going to be where they'd have the biggest advantage. And it was a 13-3. And I think that if you're going to look at any map and say, okay, where should Paper X have done better at? It's probably that one. FPX put 11 attack rounds together in a row without Paper X being able to do anything. And obviously, yeah, you have to consider that the way the economy works is there's going to be opportunities within those 11 rounds for Paper X to be on even footing with FPX, even if they're falling behind at certain points. But I think that Paper X have always been really heralded for their bind because of the way they use Forsaken on Yoru. And that's always kind of been like the Paper X thing. And Forsaken just didn't get done on Yoru in this map. And I don't know if that's if that's a case of like them relying on Forsaken, and therefore if he doesn't get something done, like in the way that we kind of talk about Ye in Optic, if Ye's having a bad day, I don't think the Paper X rely on one person to the same extent.
Definitely didn't frag out like they'd expect.
No, absolutely not. Like, I literally have it right in front of me here. He went 6-15. Like, you know, it's just incredibly, like, meh, you know? So I think that that map is probably the one that you would look at and be like, that should have gone differently. Even if FPX were going to win that map, it should never have been to that level. So that's probably the one that will hurt the most for Paper X. But then, you know, it's interesting because I think that FPX's attack almost always came to be the problem for Paper X. So I say, like, they put 11 attacking rounds together on bind against Paper X. We move on to Fracture, which was Paper X's map pick. That was map number 3. And that was, that actually, I think, was 6 and 6.5. Yeah, it was. So, like, the first half was, like, super even, could have gone either way. And as soon as FPX get onto their attacking half, oh, guess what? There is only one round that Paper X can put on the board. Then you go to Breeze, which was the final map, and this is the decider. And again, it was FPX's attack in the last six rounds that that PRX couldn't break into. So that really seemed to be the problem for them. And I think that, to me, that's, you know, says, like, okay, there's this very specific thing that FPX managed to put against PaperX. But because we've never seen these two teams interact before, we probably wouldn't have known that in advance, right? So it was still a very reasonable assumption to think that PaperX could have won, or perhaps should have won. It just so happened that when this series actually then occurred, that there was this particular issue that Paper X were facing. Now, I think that's something that they can then look at, improve upon, and then come back at Champions and be really good at, you know? Like, I don't think that's something that necessarily takes them out of the conversation of being one of the best teams in the world, or could potentially be the best team in the world. I think that FPX, just judging how things were played, deserved this win. I think that their play seemed a little bit less, like, at times two-dimensional. Like, I think that was the problem that with Paper X, that I kind of felt like, especially when they're relying on these compositions that are, you know, these neon compositions, which I've said this with Optic before, is that the problem with neon compositions is they kind of suck on defense. And it feels like that same hole was kind of fallen into for Paper X, where, you know, having your kind of trap card of, you know, being able to say, like, Forsaken, Jhin, go kill, if that's not enough, then, like, there will be other factors that can then be exploited, and it seems that that's what FPX did.
Looks like the Jhin guy, just for the whole tournament, like, he could have been the MVP as well if you give it to, like, the non-winner. Like, that guy looks like he just fragged out the whole fucking tournament. The stats are insane.
Jhin had the highest ACS bonkers, of anyone who played in the whole thing. And Jing's like a madman. Like, usually you just watch him play, particularly Raze, in my opinion, and it's just like, is nuts. And it's funny because I remember watching, it was like the Plat Chat episode that they did before the tournament even began, like before they all went to Copenhagen. And the only person who was really hardcore on the Jhin train was Sideshow. And they were all kind of laughing at him for it. Okay. They're like, hey, he's good, but okay, like, come on. And it's like, well, he kind of got proven right here.
Yeah, what do they do with fucking doubting Sideshow? He's legit. He's got a good eye for the game, I actually think. I've always thought in Overwatch he had pretty good takes actually on who was good and who was not good, etc. By the way, one thing I want to ask you was this. I notice if you look at, like, late in the tournament when all these teams are playing, I mean, maybe it's an FPX quality, I don't know, but in all these big games, the upper bracket final, the final, the low bracket, there's not many close games. Everything's like, just whoever wins just stomps the other guy. It's like, I'm 13-5, you win 13-5, then I win 13-4, you win 13-3. Like, holy shit, like, where are the close games?
One of the really weird things about this tournament was that, like, every fucking team seemed to take the other team's map and lose their own.
Right.
Like,
right.
I haven't gone back to actually count how many instances that happened, but it seemed so, like, abundant. It happened all the fucking time, and it was bizarre. It was really, really strange. And I don't know why, but no, it's true. Like, I mean, even just thinking, like, Paper X and Optic, there was another, like, 13-3 there for Paper X, and it's like, it feels really weird because this tournament felt close in a sense. Like,
it turns out who could win, it was wide open, right? Yeah,
it felt like there were teams who could have gone further. Like, I mean, Fnatic arguably could have gone further. Fnatic were who I originally thought were going to win it. But you know, and in the
maybe
game
even
where...
DRX, who knows, right? Maybe even right. DRX could have gone further, yeah.
Exactly, but it's like in the game where Fnatic got eliminated, just looking at it now, this was a three-map game. Two of those three maps, just one of the three maps was like overtime, and there were a bunch of overtime maps as well. So it's like there seemed to be really like, it was rarer to see like a 13-10. It was like either going to be like a 14-16 or it was going to be like a 13-5. Yeah, I think that's a good point that I hadn't really thought about. And your thing about DRX, like, they're an interesting one for me because I feel like we always have this where DRX, like, they don't make a deep run in the playoffs. They just make a run. You know, they're not going to be, like, first round.
They're just a tease. It's like they show you just enough to make you think, oh, something there, but then they don't ever fucking finish like you're saying, you know.
Exactly. That's it. And it's just sort of like... It makes me wonder what the next step for DRX is. Like, do they just kind of keep going? I think, who the fucking was it who suggested this? I swear I saw something on Twitter, it might have even been on the broadcast, saying, like, DRX just need to come and, like, boot camp in Europe. For, like, a month.
Yeah, that would be
a
good idea.
In NA.
Like I said on the past episode, that is actually what the Counter-Strike teams used to do. They would try and come, like, before two or three lands, and they would just, you know, boot camp for, like, 2 weeks in Sweden or Serbia or something. And that would be a good idea, because obviously you can level up sort of your experience of scrims and stuff.
Yeah, so then you have that, like... Because, you know, for example, when we had the episode where we had Paper Thin on, he was like... Well, you know, DRX versus PaperX, like, they always beat PaperX. And I get it, they're scrim partners. But you know who DRX always lose to? EU and NA teams. And again, like, that was the problem for them. They went down into the lower bracket to Optic, and then they got eliminated by FPX. And it's like, eventually, because EU and NA get combined the most number of spots in any of these events, if you make it into the playoffs, you can't avoid them. Like, you're going to have to face EU and NA teams. And that always seems to be where DRX's run kind of ends. And it's like, well, we've got great players on this team. And clearly, you know, we talk a lot about how they drill things and they like to be very specific about the way that they play. But ultimately, it gets to that point where they just haven't been able to break through this ceiling that they've been stuck at, and it just kind of makes you wonder, like, what the next thing for them is, because as you mentioned before, there aren't tons of events that happen. Like, last year there were four events, this year there were three, and it looks like that's going to be what the sort of precedent.
And that's if you even get
forward
to the champions, right? So, like, obviously the champions one sort of implied, like, you have to do some of the other ones. Yeah,
you have three. Yeah, so there are two masters events and then basically champions, which you have to qualify for. And I would say DRX, you know, you would probably generally have a good chance of doing that, because it, even if they don't, like, win anything, because they're basically just the only real Korean representation, like,
I mean,
they're going to get the circuit points from that region. Yeah. But you can't just keep hitting your head on this ceiling and just being like, oh, well, we'll come back next time. There might not always be a next time. And the number of next times is not a lot. So... you need to be making really significant strides in these gaps between the events. And I feel like DRX aren't, like, they might be making improvements based on, like, their own strengths and their domestic opponents, but you need to be making improvements that are actually going to help you in the international events. Otherwise, you're just still going to get, you know, just... that's it. Like, if your aim as a team is to just qualify for the international events and that's good enough for you, then cool, great, keep doing what you're doing. But I doubt many pro players are satisfied with just that.
By the way, what would you say about, like, the state of Valorant as a competitive game? Because when I look at the top three teams in this tournament, it seems like individual skill seems to have a massive effect on the game right now. Like, these are pretty stacked rosters that are going deep in these tournaments, right?
Yeah, they're stacked rosters, but then I think you can also point at teams that didn't get that far and also say they're stacked rosters. I mean, a really, really good example would be Loud. The fact that Loud went out as early as they didn't even make the playoffs. Like, that was insane. We had an elimination match. The elimination match in the group stages that was the grand finals of the last fucking event.
Yeah.
That's like, what the fuck? So, like... and you just can't look at Loud and be like, they're just not a stacked roster. Like, yes, they are. So I think that, it's obviously fair to say that the top three teams and the highest end teams are really stacked rosters, but I think it's more about how they like resource manage and how they use those stacked rosters, because I think that, I mean, look, like Valorant generally as a competitive scene is made up of like some portion of like previous Counter-Strike pros and then some portion of like young fucking gunner. I was going to say Adderall filled gunners, but I don't want to be making any, I'm not actually accusing anyone of taking Adderall, but like, you see what I mean? It's like these just crazy little like 18-year-olds. That gives you a big pool of people from whom you could pluck a lot of stacked players or make a lot of stacked rosters and have a lot of really, really insane players. So I don't think there is like a dearth of that in Valorant. I think it's more just becoming about the teams that can use those assets the best. Okay. And like we've talked about before, in a lot of instances, that's going to come down to flexibility, which is something that FPX are extremely good at, and also like unique ways of looking at and exploiting the game. So like PaperX would be a great example of that. You know, they have a unique way of playing, and it makes it incredibly hard for people to deal with. Optic, while I don't think they necessarily had the best individual performances of their lives at this event, I actually think that even though Optic got in the top three, they probably underperformed based on expectations.
It seems like Ye is the only one who's up in the stats, isn't he? Like the rest of them are not right.
Well, Ye was up. Ye was doing okay in the playoffs, but in the group stage, Ye was like, at the very beginning of the event, it was like, what is going on? Like, Ye is not performing. And it was very strange. So he needed like a little bit of time to kind of like get back into himself, I guess. It's not that Optic played poorly, obviously not. You can't make that argument. But I think that they just didn't look as exceptional as they usually do. But their basis is still extremely high. Like, their floor is super high.
Right.
But Optic have also been one of these teams that have, like, pioneered new ways of playing and are creative in the way that they approach the game. And so I think that that is just a very important factor. You can have, you know, like, yeah, DRX, let's use them as an example. Buzz is a really, really insane player. And I mean, someone who got spoken a lot about was RB, who, was kind of questionable on some agents, but also like some of his performances were really good and you can kind of tell this is a good player, but like, are they utilizing him? Like how they, you know, are going to get the best value out of him and stuff like that. And it's like, this is a stacked team, but they are not getting the same results as those, you know, top three. And it's more because I think there just isn't that same level of like creativity, flexibility, and like on the fly adaptation that we see in those much further up teams. And I think I've always kind of believed that, like, having a team of really good players isn't enough, because otherwise all of these quote unquote super teams that pop up in every fucking game would work, and they never do.
True.
So yeah. Like, it's just about getting the right combination. And also I suspect that a lot of it comes down to the relationship that the coach has with the team and the way that the players can work with the coach to come up with ideas, whether that's just the IGL who has a really close relationship and there's sort of that intermediary or whatever it is. But I suspect that there has to be a lot of respect and trust and willingness to innovate or at least try new things, even if they might sound crazy at first, to actually get to that point. And that's something that we're never going to see as spectators.
Oh, of course, yeah. Right, one thing I wanted to ask you was, would you actually say, like, a lot of the other past VCT events have been all about, like, a specific agent or, like, the meta's hitting a certain way, who adapts? How would you describe this one? Was this, like, a bit more run-of-the-mill? Was there anything specific that stands out?
A lot of people played Neon. I would say that Neon really showed up quite a bit.
What do you think the impact of that was in general?
Well, again, I think Neon's like an interesting agent because she's really good on attack if you can play her well, but she can be a bit more limited on defense. And I mean, so for example, Paper X in this final map of the grand finals, they pulled out this really like whack composition where they, so this is on Breeze, and they used Yoru, Neon, Breach, Astra, and someone else, and I don't remember who the last one was, but they like just pulled all this like weird shit out. And it's like, this is a crazy composition that clearly they have thought a lot about, but like on defense just didn't do that much. And it is interesting because FPX, the composition that they won that map on, was a composition that they haven't played since January. So they actually went back to this more like conservative, like sort of style of playing that's way less flashy and sort of based around new agents than what we've seen in the last few months for the most part in Valorant, which I found quite fascinating that making that jump back did that. And I do wonder how teams are going to split off from here in terms of trying to focus on, yeah, let's continue down this road of like wild ideas. And if there are going to be some teams that sort of pull back and they're like, okay, this didn't actually serve us as well as we thought maybe it would, like what are some old ideas that we can implement now and how can we use those best? And I am wondering if we will see a split of some kind as that happens. I think like, because yeah, okay, so Neon came up a lot. Obviously Chamber's still been played a lot. We saw some Jett come back in. Obviously, she hasn't been super popular since she got nerfed. And so to see some teams still decide that they want to bring her in. I mean, the fact that we saw like any Astra at all, I found so crazy. Mind Freak did a really good job while playing Astra. And she is super out of the meta at the moment. But I think this was the most like explosive that we've seen.
Oh, really?
I don't know if I would like put it down to just one specific agent, but I think at least from what we've seen in 2022, because you can always like look back to like older Valorant where you had like the flash and dash kind of stuff that was really pioneered by Vision Strikers at the time and stuff like that. And yeah, so like back then was obviously like quite explosive just by nature, but yeah.
Is there enough variety, do you think, of the agent pool? Like, do you think they should, do you want more agents to be added? Is there enough for now where we could sort of like take this set and have an interesting meta with it?
I think it's always cool to add new agents. I think actually just to add on to that last point, Fade obviously was brought in a lot for this, and I'm pretty sure that this was the first event where Fade was available. And so she sort of provides a different way of like entering and initiating and gathering information, which is obviously like a pretty big thing. She pretty much gives you wall hacks, right? So that I think really facilitates the ability to be more aggressive. And then if you're playing fast with something like a Neon or whatever, then it's sort of understandable why you would have a way less slow way of playing. But I mean, obviously I would love to see like more agents be brought in, because I think that's kind of how you build the game. I don't necessarily think it needs to be done faster or slower than it has been done up until this point. I assume that the next agent that's going to be brought in, I assume, is going to be like a controller, maybe. I mean, potentially a duelist, but I think initiators, I think there are more initiators in the game than any other role. And there's only really one agent in the game who's kind of considered unplayable, which I would argue is a very good place to be, because have only one character in your game be unplayable is wild. And I think it would be nice for, so this is Phoenix we're talking about. It would be nice for Phoenix to get a rework, maybe before a new agent is being brought in, just so that, like, it's not even like he's niche. Because, like, you can say Yoru is niche now. It's not even like Phoenix is niche. There's just no purpose for him, really. So, because I don't really believe in the philosophy that, like, every agent has to be playable in every situation, but I do think that there should always be some instance where Agent A is better than Agent B. And Phoenix doesn't fit that right now. So yeah, maybe like rework him before bringing in something new. But I think it's a good thing to be building the game. I actually get more excited about new maps than I do new agents, because I think new maps provide more of a broad way of finding new ways of looking at the game. And also, I think that like strategy that revolves around map pools is very interesting. And I think because the agents in Valorant are fairly well balanced, it's always really viable for teams to have their own preferences in how they want to play. I don't see, at least anytime soon, Valorant getting into a sort of ghosts type situation where there are only like six agents you can play, you know? So I think that new maps, for me personally, just always challenge the idea of like the correct / not correct way of playing the game, because it's a new geometry that you have to work.
Are you actually a fan generally of the Valorant maps, by the way? Because that's one thing we've never really properly talked about compared to the other games. We talk about things like map pool or veto. Because obviously the key thing is, if you know, that's one of the biggest complaints CSGO people have, by the way, about Valorant, is they hate the maps. Like, they hate the three sites. They hate the fact that like they're so small compared to like CS maps, you know, like if you ever go and watch the CS map, like Overpass, it's enormous. Like, you can walk, like, it's a joke how small the maps are. Valorant. So what's your vibe in that sense? Because obviously some of that could be CSGO pros just growing because it's a different game. Maybe the agents making it. What do you think? Like, do you think do the style of maps fit the game at the moment, do you think?
I think for me, like personally, in terms of my personal preferences, like my taste in maps has changed over the course of me playing the game. My favorite map was always Bind, which is quite a small map. And now I don't really like playing Bind that much, but I know that a lot of that is based around the fact that the agents I like to play don't necessarily match what you would typically pick on Bind these days, if that makes sense. So like, I really, really loved it during the Sky meta because I really enjoy playing Sky. Now, Sky is still viable on Bind, but I prefer playing KO. Like, KO is my favorite agent in the whole game, and I'm probably not going to pick KO in Bind. So I actually get more happy if a map comes up where KO is more viable, because that's what I enjoy playing more. And then the playstyle that you kind of do with him isn't necessarily what I'm going to find from that map. It is interesting because Split has obviously just been taken out of the rotation now that this event is over. And a lot of people are very unhappy about it because many people consider Split to be the best designed map in the whole game.
Right.
And I think the reason that people like Split a lot is because it's really like lane based. Like, the mid is very much its own separate thing, and then each of the sites are their own lanes, and the kind of channels that join them are well defined. So a lot of people really enjoy that. There isn't really like one site that is vastly preferable to the other, and to break into sites you do really have to having control of mid while also having control of the main into a site is very important. So I think that Split kind of fits this like idealized sort of image that a lot of people have for a map just because of the way it's built. The funny thing is, I never really enjoyed playing Split that much, but again, that was mostly because the agents that I really enjoy playing weren't necessarily as viable in Split. So Split was like the only map where I would roll switch. And yeah, I think that as more maps come out, we will end up with more variety in terms of map size and stuff. I mean, it was really interesting when Breeze first came out because Breeze was the first like big map, you know, and so a lot of people, that was something new to get used to. And that's why a lot of teams didn't necessarily like the map at first, because it was a new way of playing. It had big open spaces, so you needed longer range, you know, weapons. And the way you played had to be based around the fact that there are a lot of long angles and you would have to pick agent. That's why after Viper got nerfed, it was still viable to play Viper on Breeze, because she still had utility that was the best at cutting off a lot of those long angles. But then Fracture is obviously a really big map, but Fracture isn't an open map. Fracture is a very closed map. So you would choose to play something like a Raze, for example, who can really punish tight spaces. So it doesn't necessarily feel, it feels like a big map when you want to be making rotations, because rotating in Fracture, if you're an attacker, takes a long time. But like, you don't have that feeling of, you know, vastness that you do get in Breeze. Now, the newest map that's just been brought out, Pearl, is quite a small map. And, you know, you want to rotate over to the B site from the A site. Like, it's going to take you like 3 seconds. But the way that the paths kind of go is that you're quite likely to run into a defender slash attacker, whichever one you're not, while you're on your way. So it's... that's probably going to be a map that I'd imagine that if that's what, if what you just described is what the CS fans not liking and liking, that, you know, maybe wouldn't be so popular with them. But then I would hope that a new map would come out down the line, like not super far down the line, that would then be another big map. So you're going to get a lot of variety in them. And that's what I like about it. I think that if you can kind of like nail decent level design, you know, and I think having like a good, well-defined midsection in the map usually goes down quite well, because that's also why people like Ascent. And obviously different kind of like levels and stuff that you can play on, and stuff like that. I think that as long as those components are honored and you're not going too crazy in any of those, then you should be able to keep a lot of the maps within a sort of realm where you might not love one on this side of the realm, but you don't hate it. Like, it's still playable. And the same over here. So kind of different tastes, different ways of playing without making anything too extreme. It's like Rainbow Six was very guilty of this, where there were some maps in Rainbow Six that were just really, really well designed, and there were some that just simply were not competitively viable. And I think Valorant hasn't put out a map, at least yet, that isn't competitively viable. There might be maps that don't necessarily suit what you love as much, but they are all competitively viable. And so I personally see that as a win.
Yeah, yeah. I will even say as well, if people don't know, Counter-Strike Global Offensive actually has a sort of a cheat advantage in that sense, which is that obviously it uses a lot of maps that the design existed in past versions of Counter-Strike. And so when CSGO came out, we just had good maps to begin with. Whereas actually, if people don't know, in the early days of the original Counter-Strike, because it was just whatever maps were in the game, we used to have some mad inappropriate maps we used in like World Championships and stuff, where like years later, these were just taken out of the map pools and never brought back. Like, they had no business being there. Because in general, Marvel philosophy on maps is like this. I don't want any one type of map. Like, I hate in CS, for example, people obsess over the idea that like, if the map's like correctly done, it should be like, you know, like you win as many rounds on like T and CT, like it's that they think that's balanced, like it's 8-7 right. Every half, because we have max on 15 instead of 13, so it'd be the equivalent of obviously like 7-6 every half, right? But the problem with that is like, that's like a reductive philosophy, because that's like, that you're just thinking of one map thing. What I want essentially is I want all types potentially of playing style to be not like the best, but viable. That's the key thing.
Yeah.
Just if you could make it work with your team, then I want there to be maps that are like super CT side. I want there to be maps that are like all about like open defense. I want maps that are like, you have to be amazing with your utility to win. Because basically what I want is I want the players to decide who wins. I always say the same thing about the maps. I think it's really hard to design maps, because to me, again, it's a similar thing. A good map design is almost like you do a bunch of cool things, but you don't know how it's going to be used. You let the players figure it out. Like, they're going to do some amazing shit.
I think it's cool. I always say like, I get, whenever I'm streaming, I get a lot of people who are like, you know, what do you think this thing needs to be changed in the game? Do you think this needs to be, what do you think of this nerf? What do you think of this buff? And I'm like, I kind of don't care. And it's not because I don't care, but it's because I will cast slash analyze slash play the game that is in front of me. And if that is the game that is handed in front of me, that is the game that I will learn and analyze and study and play. And unless there is something truly egregious slash broken, which obviously like would need changing. And I know that, you know, some developers will look at like very extreme wind deltas as well, right? And that will be used to kind of slightly change things. But for me, I'm like, I just care about, you give me a game and I'll learn it. I don't really have like a huge opinion on what that is. I just want to to take the game that you give me and that be the basis of everything that I'm like forming opinions around. I don't really care about having a super meta opinion on what the game actually is. I just give me the game, right? And that's why like I never had super like strong opinions back in Overwatch when, you know, I mean, I actually liked the GOATS era, but like when they started really like doing those kind of balances that led to a lot of meta changes in that kind of era, and people had super strong opinions about it. And course, I'm like, dude, this is what the game is. It has sort of naturally gotten to this point. Like, I'm less interested in soapboxing about what I think it should be, and I'm more interested in looking at what teams do with this and like studying that and observing that. Like, that to me is more fun than like worrying about like, well, what it should be. Well, it's not, is it? It's not that. So I don't know. Like, I think people who play the games at a really high level have a lot stronger feelings about this, but I don't. Yeah. I'm not a great like gamer myself. And I don't necessarily care to be either. So like for me, my priorities are maybe a little bit different in how I look at it. But yeah, unless there's anything that's just like really broken about a game, I'm quite happy to just like sit back and just watch what people do. Like, I think it's fun to see people figure out new ways of doing things and how to use the game that they have been given to create victory.
I actually even think that pros, because like obviously it's a classic thing in every game that has balance, that the pros constantly like hot take react to every balance. And usually it's mega hyperbolic. It's like, wow, they ruined the whole game. I'm like, wow, it's great now. Like, it's always one extreme or the other. The other thing I would say is this. Pros definitely get ahead of themselves in the sense that there's obviously a massive distinction as well between what's fun when you play the game and when you watch the same character being played by someone else. Because I've always thought that's an area that's mega underrated by pros. I know something might be annoying to you, but unfortunately, if that dynamic plays out and it's really awesome for us spectators, we might want the game to stay like that. I'm sorry, like, there might be maps you hate that we fucking love. That's just the way the game works.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this is where like I've always kind of like understood that I'm never going to be in the majority, because using Overwatch as the example again, is I understand that a lot of people didn't like playing GOATS, but also a lot of people didn't like watching it.
Yeah, that was actually unique in that sense. No one liked it.
Watching it. I loved watching it. Sure. I thought it was fascinating to watch, but I understand that it was not an accessible way. And not that Overwatch is particularly accessible anyway.
No.
It was not an accessible meta. And so other than me enjoying it, there was not really a huge benefit to it.
I mean, what's funny about that, if people don't know, is that's a great example of exactly, that's a perfect probably example of what we're talking about. Because I remember when that first came out, I actually knew this would happen as well. I knew that what would happen was, because Monte Cristo was still in the game at the time, I knew that on the one hand, Monty's going to fucking love this meta. Because what's great about that meta,
it's so analytical.
It's the ultimate analytical one, in fact, because he likes stuff like American football. It's also one where you can look at the positions and how they're getting the little edges out of this comp, etc. And you know what comp they're going to run. It's all execution. So the problem is, I knew for Monty, he's going to love it. But as you say, everyone else hated it, even half the players hated it. Like,
well, because what a lot of, and again, this is something that I recognize as being like, I'm not like other girls, where it's like,
okay,
a lot of people really, really more than anything in esports love watching an individual pop off, like a mechanical pop off. For me, I don't really care that much about that. I like watching like a very smart team play. And I get it. It's not as flashy. It doesn't like bring, you know, it's not a montage kind of level thing. But I just know that what I actually like the most watching and appreciating about someone's gameplay is actually not in line with what the majority of people are like. So like, that's fine. Like, I understand that I'm not necessarily in the majority there, but your original point about the fact that like what is slash isn't fun for the player is not necessarily in line with what makes good sport is true. I think there does have to be a balance, because if all of your players just fucking hate playing the game, then you're starting to lose like meaning, right? But yeah, no, it's definitely true. Like, it being a good sport is and should be the primary thing. Like, I'm sure that there are many traditional sports that you could go and scrutinize and be like, well, you know what? It'd probably be more fun if we changed this rule to something else. But it's just so like it deeply ingrained as part of the sport that, yeah, of course you understand that you can't just, I don't know, do something.
I mean, the classic example people always give would be like, we're lucky in Britain that we had all of our sports established before American TV, because the joke is like, they would never let you have like a 45-minute half in football and something. The joke is they would have like gamified it, wouldn't they? They would have had like, you know, there'd be like six quarters, you know what I mean? Like there'd be like throwing section, the penalty part. They'd have all stupid gimmicks, wouldn't they? I know exactly.
Yeah. No, exactly. So, but it's just like, you know, to some people, if they went and like actually, using this example, looked at football and were like, oh, well, you know what? Like, it could actually be like more fun if we like add all this yeah, little shit. But it's like, yeah, but that's not the game, is it?
Because no, exactly.
That wouldn't be, you know, I keep wanting to like use the example of like allowing players to fight each other, but that actually is a thing in hockey. So I'm just literally just using the example that already exists. You could take that out of the game and probably save some people some concussions, but it's been accepted as
also part of the
game because it makes
the sport
better,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so it's
absolutely.
Just sort of like, it's a kind of similar thing. And I think the other thing as well that I do sympathize a little more with pro players when they react quite strongly to changes in the game is unless you're in like and even then like franchise leagues aren't safe, but you can kind of be dropped at any time. And if the role that you specialize in changes suddenly and the expectations change and what you have to be able to do changes and that no longer matches your skill set, like that could threaten your career.
Oh, for sure.
Whereas, like, you know, if we're talking about like sport, like if I play me specifically, if I play for some team as like a quarterback, they're not going to change the meta of football and suddenly quarterbacks be obsolete, are they?
That's just not a thing. No,
so
exactly.
That is something that I do sympathize with for pro players because, yeah, absolutely. Like, we've had this in tons of games where...
Oh, for sure. Happens all the time in League of Legends, I'll tell you that, yeah.
Well, right, but it's like in first-person shooters as an example, like in Overwatch, when GT Dive became out of meta, all of these Tracer players are suddenly, they have to, you know, go and flex. When GOATs became a thing, everyone had to fucking learn Brig or Zarya. And then in, you know, in Valorant, it's like, okay, you had people who specialized in just playing Jett. But now the idea of just playing Jett sounds ridiculous because the game just isn't that way anymore. But when that first changed, there were probably a lot of people who shit their fucking pants about the fact that, oh shit, like I'm a Jett specialist and now that just isn't viable anymore. And so, you have to keep up and really be ahead of that. Otherwise, yes, your career is going to be potentially threatened. And even if you do keep up with it, that does not necessarily say that you're going to be at the right level of these new changes to keep your job anyway, even if you make the effort. So I can understand that there is an element of insecurity and fear that comes from it, and especially if a change is not considered one that people enjoy or like about the game, and you then have to face the fact that your job could be in jeopardy in the name of something that you deem to be objectively shit, like I'm sure that that's a really stressful place to be. But yeah, obviously that's not something that necessarily affects me. It's just trying to think of it from their perspective.
Yeah,
I can
of course.
And that being a...
No, I'll even say as well, I actually expect that's even where you might even see more complaining in Valorant, because if you actually look, especially if people come from CSGO, that's going to be the rude awakening, isn't it? Like, the difference is you can gradually change the meta in CSGO, but as you say, you don't just wake up and find out, like, oh, there's no ops left anymore, mate. Like, what?
Yep.
I've been doing that for 10 years. Like, there's none of that. Like, whereas you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, League of Legends, because it's a similar type of game, I can tell you there absolutely are, like, amazing carry top laners where the meta becomes your player tank, and he either is just half as good at his job, or spoiler, he doesn't have a job anymore, and in comes the sub player who's the tank player. Like that happens. In fact, if people don't even know, there've been like world championship teams that had subs like that they brought in specifically for when the meta swapped. So like, it's definitely a different vibe. Yeah, as I say, if you're in CSGO, you think it's on me and it's my performance level is going to keep me in the job or not. But in this scenario, it's like you wake up one day and suddenly you're not playing what you were playing yesterday. You've got your homework, you've got to learn something new.
Yeah.
That must be very stressful. No doubt. I even think what's wild, I mean, we've touched on it in some of the past episodes. The craziest thing to me is this. In League of Legends, Geo, they have an excuse as to why they put the patches at really bad times, which is they're running the entire world of League of Legends. Like, obviously, like the Chinese League isn't exactly at the same time as the playoffs of the European League. So in that one, I can give them some, like, a pass there. Like, in theory, you're always going to be fucking with someone. It's always going to be before.
Two global events a year.
That's the problem. The problem I have with Valorant is this. I don't want to hear, like, before the last Masters, where it's like, and of course, we're coming into a meta switch. It's like, wait a minute, a meta switch right at the end of the qualification part, but before the LAN. Like, whose idea is this? Like, because logically, if you're going to have two LANs like that, I think you should just do it like we want in CSGO for our breaks. So here's the analogy. The thing that fucks up CSGO is when you have the, like, 1 month player break, right? Because everyone's level gets reset. So what we've done now, that hopefully they're going to do from now on, is we've asked Valve, just put it after the major, so it's sort of like the end of a cycle. You know, you play your tournaments, you play the championship, then you have your break, then you come back. Because this, I'd say do the patches the same way. Like, I would have the patch right after VCT Masters. Like, why not make VCT Masters be the last tournament on that patch and then swap to the next patch? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, the regions are mostly following the same sort of
look
schedule.
Fairly similar,
I think
yeah.
some of them, like, are a couple of weeks out from each other.
I think Korea was like 2 weeks earlier or something, but yeah, it's generally the same.
Yeah, because it wasn't it like with the big meta shift that happened at the end of stage one, it was like NA played their last week on the new on the new patch, but EU had already finished or something. And then
I
it was like,
so, yes.
Not only did NA have to then, you know, learn that new patch, but then it could also be considered an advantage after that because they're already used to it by the time that the event rolls around. Whenever this topic of conversation comes up, my first thought is always, I do not envy the person who has to make the decisions, like at the fucking publisher.
They're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
I would not want that job. I think this was something that Ubisoft were always very guilty of, was like bringing out a new patch right before an event. Like really, really, really bad timing. I agree that in general, I think that patches should aim to come out after a global event, but I'm sure there are like logistical parts of it that make that not as simple as it is to just stay, right?
That's one thing you always have to add into these conversations as well, because pros especially get way too much in their bag of like, I'm a pro and I'm entitled. One thing you have to say is what you said there, it was to be fair, it's really hard to balance things as well. Like even if each individual idea is right, the question is what's the knock-on effect? Like I always say to people, balancing's like fucking whack-a-mole. You hit the two moles here and five pop up behind you, like you're never going to perfectly nail it all. Like you know, who could even keep that many variables in your mind, you know, at once.
Obviously, this is just like me speculating. I don't really know what goes on in sort of like the process of doing all of this, but I wonder as well. It's like not only is there like the esports, obviously as the esports fans and people who work in esports, we want that to be the priority, but I'm sure that also like from the marketing side of things, for the majority of people who play the game, that's also on its own timeline, which may always match up to the esports. And that is a very tough pill to swallow, I think, for a lot of esports fans, is that the esport is usually not the financial priority for the publisher.
Typically hasn't been for Riot as well, because they make so much money off like League of Legends, the game, etc. So yeah, traditionally that's absolutely the way it's been. So, I'd even say as well, the other thing people really misunderstand is this. You actually also have to ask yourself that about Riot, right? Which is, who are they trying to serve? Are they actually trying to serve those of us who play the competitive game, or just the random people who play casually? Because obviously way more casual games than esports tournaments.
The casual players usually make more money for a publisher, right?
I've no doubt, yeah. All the skins and all that shite, yeah.
Exactly. Like, I believe in balancing a game around the pro level, because I think that represents the closest to correct way of playing the game that you're going to get. But I try to not be entitled about expecting everything else to be done around the pro scene, because as much as I would love that in my ideal world, I don't think the pro scene are probably the most profitable part of anything. And so you know, there will be people at the company who are probably really, really want that, but you tell that to the shareholders and they're going to tell you to fuck off. So, you know, it's a difficult one, because it's very easy to be like, oh yeah, here would be the best times to do the patches. And it's like, that might not. Because for example, so with Valorant right now, they're delaying the next patch because they're doing an engine update. And so I read the whole thread about it on Twitter, which was actually quite interesting as someone who doesn't really know how engines work. But they're doing the engine update. And so that's going to be... that's going to take a little bit of time, and then, you know, they'll release a patch, which is basically just you. I think the idea is that you don't really notice it as the player, but the game has been updated to match the engine update. And then I'm sure that there is probably a certain amount of time after that patch where the following patch is going to come out, right? And so the fact that this one has been on a delay because it's a different kind of patch, that probably changes the timeline in and of itself for the one after that. And like, I guess that will be after Champions, because Champions is in September for Valorant. So I don't know when that'll be, but like, just even little things like that, like they literally have to rebuild so many parts of the game to match the Unreal Engine update, you know? And it's like, well, you can't, you know, there's, what they're going to do, they're going to write to Unreal Engine and be like, can you please just not update your engine for now? Because we've got an event. Like, that just...
Oh, by the way, there's like the other thing that I know is very... like, this might actually be interesting info for people who don't know this. I know from League of Legends side of things, because I once had an episode, it was on my show I did with Loco Doco called Listen Loco, where we had a guy called, if you look at it, they'll call me like Riot Blastoise or something. It's a guy who works for Riot as part, I think, of like the balance and design team and that. And basically, one of the things he explained to me, and I'll admit, as an industry person, I didn't know this, but it's super complicated. So in League of Legends, I don't know exactly for Valorant, they'll have some equivalent, I'm sure. In League of Legends, basically, this is how they do it. It sounds complicated, but they have the current version of the game that everyone's playing now, if you just log into League of Legends. But then they have, like, when they're making the next patch, they have a live environment, the like pro environment where you can play just the patch. It's like being part of a beta, basically. You can go and just test that out. And the problem is, it's all about the timing of, like, how long is it in, like, the test version where people can give you feedback. But then how long before it then comes out, and then how long before it gets cycled for the next patch? And basically, that's what also makes it complicated. We're talking like they just make it like a fucking cake in some oven and then come out. There you go, enjoy the game. But it's not, it's this whole process of back and forth, and it's the timing, and when does it drop, and then when does the next cycle phase in? So it's actually, again, it's really complicated, actually. It sounds really tricky to actually know, essentially, like, how do I use this feedback of the people playing the beta, but then the people who designed it, but then the people who've, I mean, half the joke about, by the way, pros reacting. Pros will also react with a hot take just on the patch notes. They haven't even played the champion yet. You know what I mean? Like, they'll be like, this is broken. So you haven't even played it? What? Like, that's just not, it is entertainment, but ridiculous. We are ridiculous in esports, aren't we?
So my thing, and I almost feel like embarrassed whenever I admit this, because I feel like as somebody who works in esports, I shouldn't be admitting this, but
come on.
I very rarely read patch notes. I always wait for the patch to come out and then assess the general reaction from that, and also my own like experience in trying it. I never bother reading patch notes because I kind of don't really care. Like, again, this goes back to I will play the game that's in front of me, right? If this is not the game I have to deal with right now, then I just don't give a shit. It takes up brain space for me to like read it, try and remember it, form an opinion on it, which is going to mean absolutely fucking nothing before exactly. It actually comes out. I know that like people really, really care about patch notes because obviously like they're really invested and it tells you about what's going to happen with the game. And everyone like, it's one of my pet hates. It's like in esports as an analyst, they'll be like, oh, you know, what teams do you think are going to be really affected by this? Yeah, I don't care. I just want to wait. Like, let's wait until the patch is actually out, because they might change the patch between now and then anyway. And then I can give you an opinion and I will actually give a shit, because that's the game that we'll be like working with. I just don't care. I really like don't care about patch notes.
Well, listen, I think we all got the sentiment at the end there. Gio doesn't care about patch. I'll probably put that as the title of the video. I'll just say as a random aside, because the best example ever I've seen of this was way back in the day in early League of Legends. The classic Double Lift, right? Double Lift was there with his old mate Travis Gaffer doing an interview. So they haven't fucking changed the habit of a lifetime on that one, have they? They've done about 1,000 of those, broke it. This was like, you know, the interview 180 or whatever. And this was in like the first season when they did LCS. And I can't remember what champion it was. It might have been like Draven or something ridiculous like that. and there was just a champion. And this is what's hilarious. Doublelift hadn't even played this. I don't even know if he'd seen like a video of it doing the abilities. He'd just heard like the description of what Draven did. And because he's Doublelift, instead of just being like, well, that sounds a bit broken, he obviously was just like, this sounds shit. And then Riot was like really offended, obviously, because they were like, bro, it hasn't even come out yet. Like, how can you flame it? Like, and then the best thing is, because this is like the early days of LCS, I think he even had to like do an apology or something. Like, I apologize for my unprofessional. I think he even had to do one of those. Like, even though, by the way,
didn't he have to do that recently for a co-stream?
Listen, it's Doublelift. He has to fucking apologize all the time. Like, he is the sort of person you have to understand who just, it's not even that he like speaks faster than he thinks. I think sometimes he just speaks, you know, just who he is. Just one of those guys.
Sure.
As someone who's, I've mastered it. Here's the thing, Doublelift. I've got the PhD course. You're like a freshman on this shit. Hit me up. I'll tell you how you master saying things that will get you in trouble, but at least know what you're going to say. At least have some fucking forethought. And also, by the way, I mean, he was wrong. That champion's all right. It's not good. It's just all right, isn't it? Let's leave on that. This video was supported by Kill Your Inner Loser, Travis Goff, Ahmed Haju, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Hades, Animosity, Joseph Ginsburg, Tobias Bernasconi, Buttpounder 420, Jensen Gore, Kovacevic, Pacey, Tosh, Adam Ox, Toucan, and a special thanks always goes out to Jerky's Minion. Would you like to suggest a topic or a guest for my content? You want to ask me a question at one of my monthly AMAs? Do you want teasers? Find out who the upcoming guests are. Or maybe you want to take part in one of those lengthy esports discussions with moi? Well, if so, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Skrilluminati today via the Patreon link in the description box below.